This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Hello, everybody out there. Welcome to this week's show. We have a tremendous interview and stand-up comedy set from one of the finest headliners from the history of Laughs Unlimited. Ladies and gentlemen, all the way from Colorado, let's welcome Bob Duback. Bob, it's so great to hear your voice. We haven't worked together in a couple decades, but it's really great to connect again.
Oh, well, you know, it's great to hear that canned laughter.
The excitement of the crowd.
Right. You know, at least we know there are crowds out there that we've recorded. So they
still exist. Exactly. Well, we were just chit-chatting before we started the podcast. I edited a recent podcast show, and some of them are based on the television productions I did back in 1986 through 89 for ABC and NBC. And you were the headliner on one of those shows, so you're already out there in podcast land in an upcoming show. But it made me think of you, and I wanted to reach out because you were one of our regular headliners, especially in the 80s, a little bit into the early 90s. But let's not jump ahead, Bob. You've a very talented comic and actor. How'd you get started in comedy?
Well, I always started as an actor and as a writer, but you know, I found that I always performed. When I first started out, it was before comedy clubs, so I was opening for rock and roll bands and touring around with them quite a bit. So I would be the opening act, and back in that day, you know, you couldn't afford two bands, so you'd have a comic who would open and do a half hour, and it wasn't bad. I mean, I hear all these people talk about these horror stories of rock and roll audiences, but you know, in the 70s they were very appreciative because there was no other, like I said, there were no comedy clubs, there was no other outlet for any kind of entertainment whatsoever, so people would go to these, I guess nowadays they're, you know, it was a high-end kind of you know, folks coffee shop folk things, so there's, you know, the big rooms.
Well, some of those clubs were famous. The Hungry Tiger in the Bay Area. Well, you had the Cotton Club.
There were places like that all over the country. But those were the ones that got the notoriety.
Yeah. Where'd you start, Bob? And,
well, I grew up in the South. I was doing, you know, I always did some sort of show business. I was doing magic tricks at birthday parties and things like that. And then I was
Magic too?
Oh, sure. You know, and then I was doing, and I first started doing like a comedy magic act is what it was. And that's what went over well with rock and roll audiences. I first started doing it down in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. And the guy who owned Capricorn Records, which handled the Allman Brothers Band, Leonard Skinner, and all those guys who were just starting out. They weren't big yet. And he was putting them in these small rooms. He saw me and I was doing these, you know, it was kind of a carrot top magic act. Mm-hmm. And when you're performing in front of a rock and roll audience, you know, it's they need something visual.
Oh, right. And it has to be high energy to keep their attention.
Well, pretty much. And the thing is, it's not hard to keep their attention because back then everybody was stoned out of their mind. So, you know, all I'd have to do is say, hey, I'm going to make a piano disappear. And they would think that the piano disappeared. So it was, you know, it wasn't really hard to do magic tricks for a rock and roll audience. You know, I would say it was tough. It was tougher doing tricks for 5-year-olds at birthday parties than it was for a rock and roll audience.
Now, that's great information. You know, we did work together for many years, and I guess the subject never came up because I knew you as a terrific stand-up comic, and I know you were an actor, and you ended up actually doing a lot of acting into the 80s and into the 90s. But starting off as a comic magician for rock and roll bands is a different kind of start, but I bet it helped you interact with the audiences. I mean, dealing with, you know, comebacks and hecklers.
Oh, of course. You know, you kind of learned that. And they had now, you know, I emphasize there were no comedy clubs except maybe, you know, the places in like Dangerfield and the places in New York and places in L.A., the Comedy Store. But they were just getting their footing. I came out of this whole rock and roll era with an act. I mean, I had a headline act, and when they first started opening comic clubs, there weren't any headliners. They were just people who were just kind of starting out. So it was very easy for me to kind of weave from one step to the other. I mean, when I was first getting into the rock and roll business, I took over opening for bands that Steve Martin used to open up for.
Wow.
So I was opening for the Nick Gritty Dirt Band and Linda Ronstadt and Buffett and all these other, you know, rock acts. And then from there, eased into the comedy club stuff. And from that point, moved out to L.A. and, you know, pursued the acting stuff. And then from there went from, I mean, I was always a, you know, this sounds odd to say, but I didn't look like a comedian. I looked more like an actor. So that was going out for roles as a comedian weren't very successful because they always wanted some goofy looking neighbor.
I
ended up working in soap operas. So I ended up, you know.
Yeah, and everybody out there in podcast land, Google Bob Duback. You'll see what a handsome young man he is. And it's interesting that you made that transition. We should also explain to the audience, when it comes to stand-up comedy, when you said you were able to come in as a headliner because you had developed an actual act, it was so true that when I opened my club in 1980, there was a lot of funny people that we were meeting and running into, but very few that would have 40 plus minutes of material, which is really what you needed to be a headliner. You know, you could be extremely funny for 10 or 15 minutes. That didn't make you a headliner. You had to be able to fill time in a comedy club.
Well, that's true. That's true. You know, I look back on this, and even now with the whole change going on with clubs and what they have to do, hopefully they'll go back to what the original idea was. It really never was an MC, a middle, and a headliner. That was never really what the business was all about. That was a financial excuse because the MC was cheap. The middle act was just a little more expensive, and the headliner was expensive. And they convinced the audience into thinking they were going to see three acts when really they were seeing two developmental acts and then one act.
That's so true. I've not had it broken down that way, but that, as a club owner, that's exactly what I was doing.
Yeah, and I mean, you were doing it because it was something all club owners did, and nobody really came to, in Britain and overseas, they do it a little differently, and it's always held up, and even some of the specials that I've done in certain places with another comic, they actually have just two headliners and a break in the middle, and the guys swap every night.
Yeah, and
I
was just going to say I experimented with that, and I did it a couple times, but it is a more expensive way to go because a headliner, now this is back in the 80s, it was a lot of money at the time, but you might be making $12,000 to $2,000 for the week. So if you had two of them, that was much more expensive than, as you mentioned, a couple developmental acts. So that's
right.
An interesting concept that hasn't been brought up. And to be honest, I don't think I even thought of it that way. You know, I was just following the format that clubs had started out and went with that, and it worked.
Yes, and of course it worked. But, you know, nowadays we're in a whole different spectrum, and it would be nice to see it go back to the legitimate way of doing a show, because you know what it's like with, you know, and I know the club owners have to make money. They got to sell drinks, and then there's waiters and waitresses, and they're in the way, you know. Everybody knows if you're a headliner, the last 10, 15 minutes is a pain in the ass because it's nothing but people dropping checks. The best spot is really the middle spot. And if you can go in and just go in and get out and do your half hour, it's, you know, you've got the best time for the audience. But if you schedule it, and, you know, I know you don't want to bring up this, I think it'll teach us something. So if you, and I'm not trying to take away jobs from people, but I'm just looking at this from a revenue standpoint, how it'll work the best. If you just have a bar in the back and you let people go and buy their own drinks before the first act, sit down, the bar closes. Then the guy who's the headliner, who is the second act, comes out and does 5 minutes. Because originally, with the Catch Rising Star and the improv, that the MC was the best guy on the stage. So your headliner comes out and does 5 minutes, introduces the other act, which actually is a headliner, and that guy does his 40 minutes, and then you take a break. everybody wants to go to a bar, get more drinks. They can, because the bar opens back up. Then they come back and sit down, and the guy who was the one you just saw is the MC and introduces the very first headliner who closes the show. And then you swap it every night.
That's a
the one guy.
Great format, and I've never seen that done. You ever thought of being a club owner?
Well, I've done it in a few. I do it every once in a while up here in Telluride, where there's a room that's like a it's mostly a music room, but we do shows here every once in a while. And I've done it overseas with some of the, because I perform doing these solo shows nowadays.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Those are fascinating. But in the regular club format, doing a two-headliner show, the way you just explained, in my 40 years of being around stand-up comedy clubs, I've never seen that done. There was a few times.
Nobody wanted to hear it, Scott, at the time. You know, I mean, it's been around. It's just that everybody, you know, we all get very lazy with the way we, you know, have our patterns and do our things over and over. And whether it's a Canadian or a club owner or even the wait staff, you know, they do the same things. And after they've been through it and they're just, you know, walking through their jobs without any, you know, real interest in it. And of course, this isn't everybody, but it's just, it's the natural way that,
the natural order of things, right?
Right.
Well, you,
but you wouldn't have as many on staff. Your overhead would actually be lower, so you can afford those two headliners. But, you know, the only reason I bring this up is because in doing all my solo shows and traveling and promoting and producing them around the world, you learn the business end of comedy, whereas I would say 90-95% of the comedians have no idea how the business works. They always like to piss and moan and
think
about,
right. You're
you know, how they're not having, and they have no idea what the costs are. They have no idea how to, you know, run a business. And in fact, to be honest, most of them that are from my generation are sitting in a one-bedroom apartment wondering what the hell happened. And they're, you know, they're... because they didn't know how to manage a checking account.
Right, right. And you're so right, because even back when I was running the club, there was times I was trying to explain to the entertainers that, you know, yeah, there might be a couple hundred people coming into the room, and yeah, we're generating some money. And they were like, well, why isn't that all coming to me? And you're trying to explain overhead and taxes and payroll. And it was like, woo, right over their heads. But you sound like you have a real grasp on it.
Well, I've been doing it for 30 years. I mean, I kind of, not that I bailed out of comedy clubs in the late 80s, early 90s. But I kind of saw the writing on the wall. First of all, you know, when I said earlier, I came into the business already with an act and then worked real strong for 10 years doing that. And then everybody else was able to put an act together. So you're competing with each other. And then you realize, wait a minute, there's going to be more talent. And I use that term loosely. there's going to be more talent than there are stage time. So then, and if I was a club owner, I'd start nicking down the price because I got, you know, I got 10 guys to choose from. I only got 2 weeks to fill.
Right. So, right. You know, you could use that to your advantage from a business point of view. Well, we've kind of jumped ahead a little bit. I got to be honest, Bob, I don't remember your first time working for me in Laughs Unlimited. Do you have any recollection of what year? I imagine it was about 83, 84.
I don't remember the year, but I do remember that the condo, which was actually one of the nicer ones because it had its own gym, whatever comedy condo that you guys set up. So it was during that time where you still had the comedy condo. When was that, the early 80s?
Early 80s, it was called Governor Square West. In fact, for a few years, the governor was right across the hall. And it was called Governor Square, not because the governor happened to live there, but that was just a story that's come up in a couple podcasts. But yeah, no, we were, when I started the club, I was directed by other comics. I wasn't directed by my own sensibility or other club owners. It was George Wallace, Bob Saget, Shandling, people like that saying, this is what you need to do. And one of the things I tried to focus on was making sure that the entertainers, whether I paid them a lot of money or not, were treated well. And that included having good housing. So I'm glad you remember something positive.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it was positive. The only negative part is I think I stole a couple weights from the from the gym.
Well, we won't tell anybody. It's only been 40 years. Well, they may have written it off.
I stole a couple of dumbbells, I think, as I recall. and, you know, at the time, before, my roommates were Kevin Nealon and Dana Carvey.
Oh.
And I think, as I recall, we all lived in the same house up in the hills. And as I recall, a lot of times you would book us one right after another. And it's almost like I would drive up, I'd drive back, almost passing Kevin on the road, you know, on Highway 5, because he's going up to fill the slot, and then be back, and Dana's there, and he's packing up, getting ready to go the next week. So it was like this rotation that we went on.
Well, I mean, everybody knows now, knows all those names, but back in the day, I happened upon you three acts, not knowing your roommates, and I'm, of course, as a club owner, I'm going to take advantage of that and get you in as much as I can. And what I was able to do by bringing everybody in every 3 or 4 months was build a reputation and an audience so people would keep coming back to the club to see you and Kevin Nealon and Dana Carvey. So do you have any memories of working at the club other than the condo? I mean, you were there quite a bit, and you did the TV show.
Well, you know, to be honest, you look at that time period in the 80s, and there were those of us who were fueled with more than just alcohol, so our memories are a little shot.
Yeah, that's true.
I would love to say, oh, I remember a specific, you know, and believe, look, this was pre-AIDS, everybody was single, it was, I don't think what people don't realize about comedy clubs in the early 80s, it was like rock and roll in the 70s.
Oh yeah.
I mean, we were in the
thick of it. I've told the story a couple times of John Fox chasing me around the green room with a spoon of Coke, and
I mean,
certain
we all
sexual
had our,
acts happen in the green room.
Right. I barely remember the green room, but I do remember that those of us who did do drugs would pass off the names of our drug dealers.
In each town. So you were well connected when you came up.
Yeah, there was. I remember between Gary Muledeer and myself and Kelly Monteith, we all had the same guy up in Lake Tahoe.
Oh wow! I haven't heard. And, those names in a while. Those guys were great comics.
Oh yeah, Kelly and I are real good friends. And, I mean, you mentioned Shanley. Shanley and I were best friends up until his death.
Yeah,
that was a tragic loss. If you want to use this, it was. You want to use this as a segue. He helped immensely in the second show that I do around the country called The Book of Moron.
Oh, really? Was he involved in the writing or helping you develop it?
Mostly the development. He was always, he nurtured everything, and he was very skillful in not doing the writing for you, but helping direct you into, you know, pursuing right certain angles and certain things that you should kind of target and go after, and making the, you know, the flow and the actual experience. I mean, a solo show isn't just somebody up there doing his act for an hour, because you can go to a comic book set.
No, it's interesting. Yeah, and we should explain to the podcast audience that a one-man show is an interesting hybrid of a stand-up set and a play. In other words, you have to have some of the characteristics of a play, and yet you're taking your material and turning it, you know, maybe jokes or bits into a storyline. And there is a lot of writing and a lot of performance to it. Before we move into that, because I want to talk about your one-man shows. You've had some real successful ones. For your 10 years on the road, did you have any interesting experiences, work with anybody exciting, any good road stories?
Well, I hate to let you down, but
you're not letting me down.
But you know, I mean, I don't think what people understand is, you know, when you're on the road, unless you're a team, like, you know, Mac and Jamie or something, you're not with anybody else. You're either with the people who are the MCs or the opening acts that you've never met before, or you've already been to the town, like I've been to Sacramento, and there were other friends that I knew. And I think you found that when, you know, comics came into town, after a while, they kind of went off on their own because they had, you know, their own little, you know, interests and families around the city.
Right.
So, you know, I wish I could say something like, Well, I remember one time when I saw Scott Edwards passed out on the front of Laughs Unlimited with the doors wide open. And it was 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, he wishes he could say that, people. It never happened.
But hey, I don't. Yeah, but I don't.
It was interesting that, I don't know if you recall, but by the late 80s, I had 3 different clubs, 2 here in Sacramento and 1 in Stockton. And because comedy, stand-up comedy on the road is kind of a lonely business, one of the advantages of having multiple clubs in a region is the headliners would tend to get together and, you know, meet for lunch, uh-huh. meet for dinner, and do something to be around somebody they knew, a peer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, that is a great advantage. I don't think I was doing your clubs when that happened. Otherwise, I would have taken advantage of it.
So, yeah. Well, let's talk about before. I know you had some amazing one-man shows, but before we get to that, both of us have alluded to the fact that you're also a very talented actor. From my research, I know that you appeared in approximately 14 different TV shows. So you were very active in the 1900s, in the 90s and the 1900s.
I was the only person doing television.
So there goes for the a good mistake there. So in the 90s and into the 2000s, you were doing 14 different TV shows. You made appearances, and this is purely acting, not as a comic at all, right?
Yep.
And then I was just going to say, on top of that, I know that you appeared as a comic on at least 7 different shows, including Evening at the Improv. So you had... Mm-hmm. The advantage over a lot of other stand-up comics is that you had bridged that gap between acting and comedy, and you were able to make a living off of both.
Right. It was kind of fitting place. I'd have this whole comedy career going in one direction, then I had the acting in one direction. I mean, I remember when I first, you'd go off on the weekends to do a comedy club, but you had to get back in town to do auditions. But the auditions I was doing was more for dramatic roles. And after that, I'd done, all those shows that you're talking about where I'd had my experience working. From that, I was hired to do soap operas, which is actually the best, training ground for anybody. I mean, as bad as they are.
No, a lot of people don't realize. Yeah, not only is it a steady check and get you into the union and get your benefits, but you're working with a lot of other talented people on a almost daily basis. So you really get to hone your craft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you learn all the technical aspects. Not only you got to memorize and act, but you also know where to hit your light and find your spots and where the cameras are going, and much more so than doing the Tonight Show, where you got 3 cameras, you got to look and see which one's got the red bulbs on, so that which camera to look at. I mean, you do this every day doing a soap opera, and you have to make very weak material work. So
that's where the acting comes in.
Right. The problem with soap operas were, it doesn't matter. Say you're on a scale of 1 to 10, you're an actor who's got the chops of a 2. And an actor who's got the chops of a 10, you'll both look like 6s because the material you can only do so much with it. So the great actors really don't look so great, and the terrible actors look pretty decent. So
when you were mentioning that I was commenting that you bridged acting and comedy, and that you were saying how, one week you were working as a headliner at a club and the next week you're doing showcases. It was a very similar path that Tom McTeague took. Tom was doing some serious acting, and then, the next week he'd be out on the road headlining somewhere. It sounds like you had kind of a similar experience. He went down the path of TV commercials, and you went down the path of soap operas and TV shows. In fact, I know that in between you did the one-man shows, which we're leading up to. But even as recently as last year, you were working on Real Geezers of Beverly Hills?
Kelly Von Teith's show. And it's Kelly, as you should probably talk to him if you would enjoy some stories and some old parts of the business that were my generation, because my generation is more, Dana and Kevin.
Right. Now, Kelly's from the generation right before. that one.
Yeah, Kelly's more like Gallagher and Fred Dreesen and all those guys that have were at the very beginnings of all this. And so,
yeah, Kelly worked the club just a couple times, but I remember him fondly, and he was a professional that had a lot of experience, and that's always something from a club owner's point of view. And, you know, we're dealing with a lot of amateurs and open micers and, like you said, the people training. So when you get somebody like Kelly Monteith coming in, you definitely get a different feel and energy in the room.
You know, Kelly lived in England for a number of years and had his own show there on the BBC. I mean, here's a guy who performed for the Queen of England. And in the meantime, he's doing Laughs Unlimited in Sacramento. So it shows you how fickle the business is.
How Kelly bizarre started, show business is.
Exactly. So he started, he and I are also very close, and he started writing when the internet started doing these, and YouTube starts with these small little, you know, 4 or 5 minute episodes. That's what he wrote whole arc of about, it's really about the length of a movie, but we cut it up so that it's about 10 or 12 episodes. So,
well, it's similar to Monty Python.
I play one of the characters in that. Actually, his is more of an episodic. It's about a guy who is, you know.
Oh, so connected pieces.
Yes, they're all
Monty
connected.
Python
so
was
a story.
Independent segments that didn't really connect.
Right. This does. And it's just like any anthology that you'd watch on Netflix. It's just, you know, instead of it being an hour-long episode, it's a six-minute-long episode. It connects.
Oh, interesting.
And, but what we've done, what I've done recently, because, you know, you just to help them out. Otherwise, my focus now isn't really, I'm writing and acting and doing my own shows.
Well, let's talk about that, because I'm not familiar. I sadly haven't seen one, but I did a little research. And I know you started off with Male Intelligence, the Oxymoron. I think that was the first one, right?
The Male Intellect.
Male Intellect.
Oxymoron. It's set up as a joke. Yeah, and if you bastardize the joke, Scott, like you just did, then it's not going to be funny. But the title is The Male Intellect, an Oxymoron.
There you go. That's
so
the way it should be
said.
It's a joke
in a title. Right. And that was all about relationships. Now I started writing that when I was on the soap opera, because I realized once I got out of the soap opera, what am I going to do? Go back to doing comedy clubs and auditions for, you know? It just it's one thing that I did learn from Mule Deer and Steve Martin and these other guys is, you know, you can't be the opening act. You can't be replaceable. Because you're going to end up in a one-bedroom apartment.
Yeah. Well, plus the road. The road's a hard gig.
It is. When I go on the road now, I go and I do theaters, and I do people come to see the show because that's what they're getting the money's worth. Whether it's The Male Intellect or The Book of Moron or Stand Up Jesus or even another show that I wrote for a friend of mine called Happyville. I mean, those are the four that are around that people in the theater circuit know the shows. And audiences go and, you know, pay to see the show, because it doesn't matter if I do it or not. I mean, I've had my shows being translated in different languages. They're running, you know, right now they're running over in Turkey and
that's Istanbul. Interesting.
Yeah.
And the comedy
carries.
And
I had other actors in the States. Yeah. Other actors in the States, ironically, comedians were always the worst to audition for my show because they didn't have the chops on how to act. I do a lot of different characters in the show too. So when you're watching the narrative, I portray all these characters that tell the story. So,
hey, Bob,
mostly,
let's take a minute and educate me. I kind of know, but educate the listening audience to put together a 1 hour or I don't know how long your shows are, but a solo one man show. You are basically acting as the writer, the director, the talent, and in a lot of cases, you're self-producing. Is that how you got started, or did you have backers and that produced you?
A little bit of both. The writing and the acting putting the show together, yes, a little help with some directing. The first guy who helped me, well, not the first, but the main director for The Male Intellect and Oxymoron was Blake Edwards.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, start at the bottom there, Bob.
Right. Exactly. So, and then, like I said, with The Book of Morons, Gary Shandling helped me quite a bit. But it's a long process. It's not just getting up there stringing a bunch of jokes together.
Oh, no. I've worked with
the headliner too.
Yeah, I've worked with a few people that have done put together one man shows, and it and as I said, you're basically performing or producing a play, and you not only have to fill the stage with the feel of a play, but also the characters and the writing and the energy. Except it's all falling on the shoulders of one person. I've always really respected people that could do one-man show, and there's not a lot that can and do it successfully. You've mentioned all three. You've had The Male Intellect, an oxymoron, Book of Moron, and Stand Up Jesus, your most recent, right?
Correct. Yep.
And to put together three of these over how many years have you been doing this, 15, 20 years?
Yeah, it's been about 20 years. I mean, I kind of learned as I went along. The first one, The Male Intellect, took, I don't know, 5 years to do and put together, and then another 5 years. Once you have the show set, then you got to get people to buy it or people where places to put it. And you can't really, you know, comedy clubs aren't going to do it because they want an opening middle and a headliner, and they want to serve liquor and food, and it just doesn't work. So you go into theaters. Now, fortunately, the first place I did The Male Intellect was in Denver, and I was in a small little place and got great reviews. And the local theater company, the Denver Center, put it up. And this is back before YouTube and before
Oh, right. This is pre-internet. Yeah.
So you could run a show. I ran the show in Denver for 9 months.
Did you really? That's a great run.
And then from Denver, I went to Chicago, and I ran for 18 months. Then I went to Boston for 9 months. And then by then, got a, and this was when Blake was involved, and we were going to bring it to Broadway, but then we realized, and this is from the very beginning of our conversation, where you understand the finance that's involved in this, even though we had the chance to do Broadway, there was no point in it because you have to give up your rights and you have to give up basically all your income. I mean, because the guy who's to put up a show even back then would have cost $250,000. So you have to pay those producers back. And then they have to recoup that money by putting you out on the road. And the only thing you get out of saying that I ran on Broadway was the fact that you can say I ran on Broadway.
Right, right. But financially, it's not easy at all.
Right, but in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, that made sense because every Lord House sort of was around the country is direct from Broadway. So people would, that's all you advertising you needed. But when we got to the point, and this was in the mid-90s, we decided not to do it because we had done Denver, we had sold out Chicago, we sold out Boston, we already had people around in the theater community knew the show was successful, so they would just book us on its own.
Wow.
So I did that show and I still do it because it's when you write these solo shows, they have to be kind of evergreens. They can't be, we have guys like...
Yeah, no, you have to make them so the material works not only wherever you are in the country or the world, but also whatever year it is. You can't have them be too specific because... Yeah, then you lose.
I mean, we've
it,
got The Daily Show, we've got Colbert, we've got these guys that can, take current events and it's a revolving door; it comes and goes. You want people to pay money to come and see something; it has to have a lot of resonance to it.
So. Yeah, I was always intrigued by it. We did it a couple times. There was Paul and Phil did a lot of TV, but they did a two man show called Live Radio Theater, which is a series of vignettes brought off like a play. And then Big Daddy's Barbecue came in as a one-man show.
Oh, sure, Jeff.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know Jeff why Wayne. Jeff has never been able to get that going. I think it's, but, he's one of the few people who has done something, but it's here's what, and I hate to be that critical, but the only reason why is because I've had guys like, you know, Blake Edwards and Gary Shandling, and even doing this over and over and working my way through the theater, knowing even when you get the show complete, it's really only 60-70% there. And most of the comedians and people that I know won't put the extra effort in it, into it, because it just takes too much work.
Well, and like we've alluded to, it's not just the directing, the writing, the performing, which all sounds overcoming. It's also the producing. It's the financial side. It's the rehearsals. It's getting it, the marks down like a play. So it really is something to achieve for.
It's hard to teach that to a guy who stands up and holds a microphone center stage and maybe walks from one side of the stage to the other side of the stage.
No, it's totally different.
I would love to thank guys who have, I know their material and I know how to make it into a show. It's just that they don't have the discipline or the intention to see it through.
Well, the commitment, you really have to be committed. Now you did mail and tell, I keep stepping on that one. The oxymoron,
male
intellect, that'll be me. And then you went into Book of Moron, and how long did that run? I mean, I know you still can perform them, but...
I just finished a big run, and I went back to Chicago in February of this last year with the Book of Moron. I played the Niederlander joint, which is a big... the Niederlanders are big in the theater business, especially Broadway and around the country. And we did a huge business, so we were going to extend and run in Chicago, and then that's when the pandemic hit. So I haven't worked since then.
And then that when did the most stand-up Jesus come along?
And stand-up Jesus, I've been working on off and on over the years, and now that I've had this time off, I just put pen to pencil and to paper and.
Has really that one been performed yet, or is that something coming in the future?
It's both. I've done it. I did it in Austin. I did it, I did it. The way you can workshop these out is there are little theater festivals around.
Oh, right. That's a big place to test something.
And it is. And it's a very appreciative audience because they have no idea that they're going to laugh their ass off nonstop for 90 minutes.
Right.
They just think, a solo show, somebody's going to stand up there and tell me about how they were abused by their father or, raped by a priest or something.
You're mentioning the fringe of comedy and where it can go, but I got to tell you, you would probably run into some confrontation when you say stand up Jesus. Is this?
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Is this a show that's going to bend a few ears? Is it?
It's going to offend a lot. Here's the thing.
He says proudly.
If you look at the three shows I do, it's basically sex, politics, and religion. So the first show, The Male Intellect, is all about relationships. The guy tries to figure out how to grow up, which is almost an impossible feat for a comedian. Comedians usually start getting laughs when they're in their 20s. And getting laughs is like any other drug or addiction. It's a hit. And it dwarfs your maturity. So that's why we have these guys that are my age that are still acting like 20-year-olds. It's kind of embarrassing. For me, it's embarrassing. And they're still doing dick jokes. I think that's the big downfall of Saturday Night Live is they went after Kevin and Dana's troupe, they went straight to dick jokes.
Yeah.
If you take all the dick jokes out of Saturday Night Live, the show will be 10 minutes long.
Yeah. I was a big fan of the show the first few years, and then I don't think I've seen it in 20 years or more.
But see, here's what people don't, we can criticize it, but Lorne Michaels knows the finance and the business, and he knows the audience wants dick jokes because they're still in high school that are watching the show. When I was in high school and college, we would watch Saturday Night Live and then go out and stay out till 4 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
After the party era stopped, and especially with AIDS, you had people go home, watch Saturday Night Live, and go to sleep. And who is that? That's going to be high school kids that can't go out. That's going to be younger people that can't. So that's who Lauren catered to.
Well, that's where the money was, yeah.
And that's where the money is, of course. you know. Well, so
this has really been fascinating, Bob. I haven't, I've done several interviews, but I haven't chatted with anybody that's been so successful with not one, but three one-man shows, been a terrific actor and made money doing that, and started off at clubs like mine. And then who knew you were a comic magician at one point? I mean, you've really had a wealth of experience that has, I'm sure, helped you be the performer you are now.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's that repetitiveness. I mean, the whole time that I was doing, starting off in this, I mean, I studied with an acting coach by the name of Sanford Meisner, and I don't know if many of your listeners know about it, but it was Stella Adler, Sanford Meisner, and Lee Strasberg, who were the three main components of acting that learned from Stanislavski, which was a Russian director and acting teacher, and they turned the American acting over and made it its own, and that was in the 20s, the 30s. And he was still alive back in the, Sandy was. And I studied with him personally. So the techniques that they taught is something most comedians have never practiced. And here's the problem. The main focus on acting is that you have to listen. The main focus in stand-up comedy is you never shut up. So you never listen.
That is so true.
And so that's why it makes it so hard. Anytime a comedian, there's silence, he freaks out. And of course we all do, because we've been on stage and you know, the flop sweat starts and nothing. But there's a way to work through it. And Chandling was a master at this too, because he studied with a guy who was a Sanford Meisner pupil as well. So, I mean, there are certain people who know the techniques of, it's not what you say, it's how you react to what you hear.
Wow. That's actually really a truism that I think we don't normally realize or think of.
No.
And I come from the comedy club era of 80s and the 90s, where, like you said, it was, you didn't want any downtime or quiet time. You wanted to bang through. You talked, you didn't listen. I was the MC at my club, so I did a little bit more interaction with the audience, so you had to listen. But the entertainers, mm-hmm. 8 times out of 10, they were plowing through their material just hoping to get so many laughs per minute.
Right. And, you know, I mean, that also, they're, the better they got, the more finesse they had. But still, when you get into a dramatic situation or even a comedic situation with other actors, it's real hard if you don't have the technique to just shut up and listen and react the way you would, you know, under these imaginary circumstances.
Yeah. Now these one-man
the whole solo shows. Yeah.
Right. And these solo shows have been what you've spent your last 20 years working on honing and producing. So now it's 2020. Is there a plan? Do you have a schedule for the next year or two to keep to get like Stand Up Jesus out there? I know you're still doing Book of Moron.
Yeah. Well, I still do all three. In fact, a lot of times I'll book all three as a weekly event. I do one show on Friday, one show Saturday, one show Sunday.
Oh, really? And that doesn't confuse you?
Not really, because I can't remember anything else. Like, I can't remember any stories from going to Sacramento at Last Unlimited, but I can remember
hours
of shows that I do, and it's taken up my brain, and that's all I've got left.
You've got it all there. Well, I'm going to bring this back down, and I want people to keep an eye out. You're producing and being seen all over the country, right?
Yes, but it's all in theaters. And it's like being under the radar in the comedy circle. Nobody has, and it's a shame, but, you know, comedians, they stay in their own bubble, so they never go and search out what else there is. I mean, anytime I'm in a town, I always go to the local club just to see if there's anybody there and just to, you know
hang out.
But nobody does the other. No, I never see comedians doing it the other way around, because I guess they just don't understand that there's a whole different...
There's more out there.
Reward and business. I mean, the money and the career that I've had and made doing these shows is just as profitable as having a sitcom.
Oh, I imagine.
I got residual checks that come in from all over the world from guys who are doing the show in, you know, in Budapest.
Wow.
You know, and it's just like,
that's
it's
incredible.
Like getting a check from, you know, your residual check from doing a commercial. So,
well, the reason I asked was because this podcast heard all over the country. It's actually heard all over the world, but all over the country. I just wanted to let the listening audience know that keep an eye out. If you hear about the show Male Intellect, an oxymoron, Book of Moron, and Stand Up Jesus, or you see the name Bob Duback, stop, take a minute, and find yourself in that show, because I think you'll be quite entertained.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yes, and that's, regrettably, nothing is getting booked in the theaters. We're the last ones to go to work, so it'll be 2022 before the tours start up again.
It's going to be crazy. But you know what? We've covered your comedic acting and one-man show life, but this podcast is all about stand-up comedy, and so we're going to end it with some material I have of you doing your stage comedy from back in the 80s. So with your permission, I'm going to share about 5 minutes of material with the listening audience. But it's been great catching up with you.
Oh, well, thanks. And I probably won't even remember what those 5 minutes are. So I'll sit here and listen to it. And I'll critique myself. I'm sure I'll be extremely critical.
Exactly. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a really terrific interview with Bob Duback, a very talented comic, actor, magician, one-man show producer, you name it. He's done it all. Let's hear some of his stand-up comedy. Bob, thanks so much for doing the interview.
Sure. You bet. Thanks, Scott.
All right, here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, some comedy by Bob Duback.
You guys, a question right off the top. You like to get freaked out? All right, go ahead. Hurry up. Come on. Let's get it over with now. Is that it? I like to have fun. I think we're too serious nowadays. Next time you're at like a family gathering, you're talking to your mom and dad at the dinner table. You want to have some fun? Crack up the table. You look at your mom. You go, yeah, mom. No, everything's fine. Hmm? Hmm. No, everything is just perfect. I guarantee you'll crack the whole table up. Your mom will still slap the hell out of you, but it will crack the whole table up. So that's the idea. We got to have some fun. We are too serious nowadays. Let's have some grins. What do you say, huh? Tomorrow, you want to have fun? You driving down the street, see people at a bus stop waiting for a bus, drive past them, roll your window down, yell out, hey, bus ain't coming today. Roll it up, take off. You check out of a hotel room before you leave, rearrange the furniture. It'll freak out the maids who come in to work the next day. And they don't speak English, so they can't complain to anybody. Now, the next time you're in a department store, pretend you work there. There's always somebody who comes up and says, hey, you work here? Yep. How much is that television set? Take it. It's yours. Go ahead. It's on the house. Walk out the doors with it. If those lights start flashing, just means you're special. All right? Have fun all the time. Sometimes I have sick fun. Sometimes I get a hearse and I drive around just to pick up hitchhikers. Yeah, you want to sit in the back? Go ahead. Stretch out. Bus ain't coming. I got a great sick costume for Halloween. Put a chair on your head. Go out as used gum. Think about it. Next time you're on an airplane, you want to have some fun. Sneak back with the stewardess and have their microphone. Make this announcement. Hi there, this is your captain speaking. We're at 30,000 feet. A few folks on the left-hand side of the airplane look to your right. You folks on the right-hand side look to your left. You'll find you idiots are looking at each other. We've actually figured out a way to get the country out of debt. We enact a new law, one law only. We call it the stupid law, which means if you catch somebody doing something stupid in public, you can charge them $5. Get this country out of debt in about a month and a half, wouldn't it, huh? You go in an office building, push a button in the elevator button is lit. Somebody will walk right in front of you and push that button again. Hey, $5. Let's go. Pay up, pal. Come on. That damn thing isn't coming any faster. Let's go. $5. You owe me $5. You did something stupid. I caught you. It's the law. What law? The stupid law. Oh, you never heard about it? You know why? Because you're stupid. That's why. Now you owe me $10. All right? Let's go. Pay up. And he pays you, proves he's stupid. Charge him $5 more. Come on. I was just down south where people have a southern accent, obviously, and they talk like this. It's kind of a neat way of talking, isn't it? But you only want to talk with a southern accent when you're in the South. You don't walk up to New York going, boy, boy, look at here. You got skyscrapers and, what's that, a bus on tracks goes underground? That's a subway? Well, I'll be damned. People in New York go, hey, $5. Let's go. Pay up, pal. Come on. But people in the South aren't stupid. It just sounds stupid, the accent. In fact, they're more intelligent than we are. Because when they talk, they don't move their lips. It's like a bunch of ventriloquists down there, isn't it? Some poor jerk from New York walks in a bar in Montgomery, Alabama. A bunch of rednecks look at him. They go, how you doing there, city slicker? Yeah, I'm going to kick your ear in right to the state line. There's 10 of us here. You got to figure out which of us is talking to you, too, don't you, huh? I grew up in the South. I'm a Catholic. Like most Catholics, when I grew up, I quit. I believe in the Freddie Flintstone religion now. Do unto others as they yabba-dabba do unto you. Right. I don't know. It's just that each religion has its own criteria to get into heaven, right? I mean, if you're Catholic, you want to get to heaven, you can't have sex unless you're married. If you're Jewish, you want to get to heaven, you can't eat pork. Now, come on, if you had to make a choice, what do you think it'd be? Well, I'm going to abstain from luau's for the rest of my life. All right, Padre? I'm going to go for the flesh picnics right over here. Personally, I think Jesus had a great sense of humor. He had to. Of course, you couldn't tell him a joke. You start telling Jesus a joke, you go, hey, I've heard it. Not only that, I wrote it. But the whole idea is to have fun down here. In fact, I want to die having fun. I want to die freaking somebody out. You know where I think it could be a good place to die? A restaurant. Right next to a kid who won't eat his vegetables. Right when his mother says, come on, Billy, eat your broccoli. It's not going to kill you. That's when I go, boom! I fall dead with a little piece of broccoli hanging out of my mouth.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Bob Duback live on stage back in the mid-80s, a very talented headlining comic that turned his interest in entertainment, theater, and comedy into not only a terrific career as an actor, but also a series of very successful one-man shows that you can still see today. We want to thank Bob for taking time and doing the interview. And if you'd like to find out about his one-man shows, go to his website, robertduback.com. His official first name, Robert Duback, D-U-B-A-C.com. And check out, there's information on his shows and where they're performing. And it's something that's a don't miss. All right. So thanks for listening to the show. We'll be back next week with another great lineup of stand-up comedy. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.